I'm beginning to speak tonight on the subject, Reasons for Troubles in the Lives of Christians. I'm sure that this is one of the big mysteries in life. When one is walking with the Lord, endeavoring to do His will, trying to experience the direction and guidance of God in his life, and then he discovers that he experiences disease or physical weakness or accident or unemployment or financial struggle or family problems or emotional and nervous disturbances, he wonders, why does this happen? I think that probably a minister and a doctor know more of trouble probably than any other one. And many, many times when I know the congregation of devoted, many times dedicated people who are experiencing troubles in their lives, I have to admit to you that many times the question comes to me, why? But this has always been true. John the Baptist raised this question. Just for a moment, I ask you to read in the Scriptures with me and notice that this has been a question raised in the minds of God's people for, I suppose, from the beginning. We read this evening in the 11th chapter of Matthew an interesting event in the life of the one of whom Jesus said there'd never been a greater born of woman. And you will remember that this was in the 11th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, where Jesus said of John that there was never born of woman a greater than John the Baptist. And yet John had this same question that was reared in his mind. I'd like to read to you briefly this evening, verses 2 through probably 5 or 6, and then help you to see how this was the question in the mind of John. When John had heard in the prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said unto him, Art thou he that should come, or do we look for another? Jesus answered and said unto them, Go and show John again those things which you do hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And verse 6 is an important statement that he gave. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me. And then as they departed, Jesus explained to the multitude, among other things, the fact that there has never been or had never been born of woman a greater human life than the life of John Baptist. Now, to know what John really asks, you have to understand this, that at the time this event occurred, John Baptist had been in prison about 12 months. If you know the life of the Lord very well, you will understand that just a short while after Jesus attended that first Passover feast at Jerusalem, and he stayed in Judea and was working, and shortly after that, John Baptist was put in prison, and the Scriptures record that when that happened, Jesus departed out of Judea, knowing that if he stayed in that area, he would precipitate his own premature arrest. And so he went away into Galilee. And now, approximately, if we understand the Gospels correctly, and I think Bible scholars are able to trace the chronological life of Jesus quite accurately, and if we understand it correctly, about 12 months have elapsed, and John is still in prison. And the question that John really asks here, if you understand it, is why? He is saying, I had believed that Jesus was the Messiah who was promised to come and bring deliverance. I was the forerunner. We had believed that he was the one promised Israel to restore Israel to its place of prominence and headship among the nations. We have been committed to the fact that Jesus was that Old Testament Messiah who would deliver us out from underneath Rome and restore us to our place among the nations. And if He is Messiah, why am I still in prison? Why is it that He hasn't delivered us, taken me out of prison, established the kingdom, and placed us at our place? And so He sent to Jesus this word, "Are you really He? If so," the implication is, "why am I in prison?" See, this is the question that John had. The question was, why? And we ask this question, don't we? If we do not ask the question why, then we go further and we ask, is there a reason? Or are events a matter merely of chance? Do the events, and I propose to suggest to you and set before you this question tonight, do the events of life have reason? I'd like to ask you to try seriously to ponder this for a moment. And in your own mind, endeavor to answer it satisfactorily. Do the events of life have reason? Or are the events of life a matter of chance? And we ask ourselves this question quite often. I want to say at this point that I believe that we can be misguided in seeking individual reasons for everything that happens. That may sound to you like a strange statement to come from me, who is regarded everywhere by people who know me as extremely conservative. But I believe that we wish that we can be misguided in seeking individual reasons for everything that happens. And this brings me tonight to the first reason that I suggest to you for troubles in the lives of Christians. And the first reason that I suggest to you for reasons is a disordered world in which redemption has not yet been finished, and bodies in which death is at work. Let me invite you now to take the Bible and turn for a moment to the book of Romans and the 8th chapter, and let us notice a statement written by Paul and find certain important implications in this statement. Romans chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. For there the apostle is inspired to write these words, "For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only they, but ourselves also, who have the first fruits of the spirits, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our bodies," or of our body. Trouble is an inherent part of the unredeemed world. And as long as we are a part of this unredeemed world, we will, by virtue of that fact, suffer some of the effects of being a part of a creation which has not yet been redeemed. It has been redeemed positionally. It has been redeemed possibly, but it has not been redeemed yet experientially. And because of the fact that we are a part of a creation which has not yet experienced the accomplishment of its redemption, we will of necessity, as long as we are a part of that, experience some of the effects of a disordered world and its sin. You see, God has certain effects and laws which are at work in our world. If an airplane's engine stops, the plane crashes. Why? Because there are certain effects at work in our world. God could suspend the law of gravity and save 76 lives, some of whom are probably earnest believers in Jesus Christ. But if the Lord suspended the law of gravity to save some of those who are His own people, then all of the people of the world, some 3 billion of them, would suddenly not be able to walk. Fire breaks out in an orphanage and 100 children die. The Lord could miraculously suspend the danger of fire and save those lives. But if he did so, the same flame saves thousands of lives by septic surgery that same day. What I'm saying is that we are a part of a creation at which sin is at work. And this creation of which we are a part has certain effects that are the consequence of sin at work in it. And until the time comes that God takes that creation and restores it to perfection, we will, as long as we are a part of this creation, necessarily suffer some of the effects that result from being a part of it. You see, it seems to me that it is a mistake to seek to find individual purpose for every trouble in life. We must recognize, as I have been stressing, that just being a part of creation that's groaning while it waits redemption because of the effects of a disorder within it, we too will suffer some of those effects merely because we are a part of this. We recognize that we have unredeemed bodies that are subject to divine, the principle of death. We therefore will be touched by the effects of it. I can give you an example that's a personal example, but it will illustrate what I'm trying to say. For many years I've studied ours and have never felt the effects of it. But I have begun to feel the results of maturing in recent months, so that a few weeks ago I began to discover that when I had read and studied for 4 or 5 hours, my eyes began to blur and I began to have severe headaches. So I, of course, went to the doctor who examined my eyes and said, "You will have to have reading glasses, and within 3 or 4 years you will have to have glasses to see anything that's near to you." Now, I have not sought a reason for that, because I recognize the fact that in this world I have a body that is subject to the death principle. And I assume the fact that as long as I'm in this world and in this unredeemed, the body that hasn't been glorified, this unglorified body, there are going to be certain effects that come about, and the only reason for those effects is the fact that I have an unglorified body. I assume that in this world in which I live, we're in a world that's groaning, as Paul writes in Romans. The effects of sin are all about it. Disorder is all about it. Society is disjointed. Satan is at work. Evil is rampant. This world lies in the hand of the wicked one. And as long as that is true, everyone who is in that world will suffer some of the effects of this disordered world merely because he is a part of that world that God has not yet restored to its intended end of perfection. And so, we understand that the first reason for some troubles in the lives of Christians is the fact of a disordered world and bodies that are subject to the death principle, both of which have not yet been perfected or glorified. You see, if we don't recognize this, we can be very much like Christians who attribute all of their difficulties to Satan. So that we have this strange sight and sound of thousands of Christians all over the world, all of whom have Satan attacking them at the same time. All of the way from the North Pole to the equator, and pretty soon from the bottom of the Grand Canyon to the moon, there are thousands of Christians who at the same time say, "Satan was attacking me." And yet Satan is not omnipresent. He's a created being who's at one place at one time. He cannot be attacking thousands of Christians all over the world at the same time. The fact of the matter is, as you well know the story of the man who missed his train to work on Monday morning And he said, Satan caused me to miss the train. The fact of the matter is, his flesh caused him to miss the train. He just couldn't get up in time. You see, many of our difficulties are not the result of direct satanic approach. They are the result of a flesh, a body, that has not yet been glorified. In a similar way, some of the troubles, many of the troubles that Christians experience in their lives, I am convinced, are simply a result of the fact that we still live in bodies in which death is at work and in a world in which evil is at work, and living in that kind of a creation that's groaning, waiting for redemption, to wit the adoption, we will suffer some of the effects of living in that environment. And this is one of the reasons for some of the troubles that are experienced in the lives of Christians. However, I will point out to you this evening that even such consequences as these can be used to good advantage rather than to hurt us. Our attitude will determine whether even a headache is turned to advantage. And I don't think that we look again for an individual reason for that. It's due to the fact that we live in a disordered world and in bodies that are subject to death. And until the time of glorification, we will suffer some of the effects of this kind of an environment. So our reaction is tremendously important even to these kinds of events. Let me point out to you that we need to be prepared for the fact also that we are not intended to know in this life reasons for all of the things that happen to us. I am, as you can tell, trying to introduce the subject that will follow and some of the other reasons. Not only are some of the troubles that are suffered in the lives of Christians just a result of the fact that we live in a world that's disordered and in a body that is subject to death, but we also have to be ready to recognize that we are not intended in this life to know the reasons for all of the things that will happen to us. I find the statement of the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 extremely helpful in this light. I'd like to read that statement to you as it is translated by Phillips in his modern translation. And it is as follows. At present, all we see is the baffling reflection of reality. We are like men looking at a landscape in a small mirror. The time will come when we shall see reality whole and face to face. At present, however, all I know is a little fraction of the truth. But the time will come when I shall know it as fully as God now knows me. Now, some of you know that there's a great deal of discussion among Bible students concerning the time that Paul refers to here, the time when he shall understand things as God understands them. Nevertheless, it is a fact that Paul points out that he, at least at that time, only understood a fraction of the picture, and he said that to look at the world was for him, even Paul with his spiritual life, was like looking to understand things was like looking at the landscape in a little mirror. He could only see a segment of it. He was unable, even Paul admits he was unable to understand and to see the whole picture. He said, the time will come when I shall know, but presently I do not understand all that there is about truth. Nor do I see the whole picture, nor understand all of the world. I just see what appears to be a little part of the landscape. And you and I have to be prepared for the fact that we often are not intended in this life to know the reasons for many of the things that happen to us. When I was a student in college, I played the double B-flat tuba and the E-flat tuba. And it was the hardest thing in the world for me to practice that instrument Because if you're familiar with it, there's nothing more uninspiring than the tuba alone. And so I would struggle with a piece of music, take it home, practice it at the college on the double B flat or E flat tuba, and the piece of music made no sense at all. But I would labor along until the time would come for the rehearsal of the brass section. And then all of the brass instruments met together to put this together. And for the first time then, I would begin a little bit to enjoy the music, because along with other brass instruments, I could begin to see how the music for the double B-flat tuba fit into a harmonious and enjoyable experience. And then, even then, however, it was still limited, some of the enjoyment, but after the brass section had rehearsed, then the whole orchestra met together and would rehearse together. And then I loved the tuba, because that piece of music fit in so beautifully to make a perfect and harmonious and an enjoyable experience. Our lives are a great deal like that here. We live them out, and many times we see experiences that appear to have no relationship, no direction, no purpose, and sometimes we wonder what can be the reason for such unrelated, purposely, apparently meaningless events. And Paul is saying that this is something he only has partial knowledge of, but the time is coming, he says, when all of this is put together in God's perfect plan, that he shall know it thoroughly and he shall find that there was a beautiful reason for it all. But I want to tell you this evening that while in the studies that are to come, I fully intend to offer to you at least seven other reasons for trouble in the lives of Christians. I want to preface that by reminding you that there will always be many events in life which we are never intended in this life to understand the reasons for it. The Apostle Paul was the first to admit in 1 Corinthians 13 that he had only a partial, limited knowledge of the events of life, and his understanding of the perfect and beautiful whole would only come at some future time. And so while I hope to be able to suggest to you some reasons for troubles in the lives of Christians, I must remind you that there shall be many events that you will never in this life be able to know the reason why God has let you experience it. However, I began this study with the first reason, which is that we have many troubles and experiences because we're a part of a disordered world and have bodies that are not yet glorified, and we have experiences that are just the natural consequences of this kind of experience. We must be alert to the fact, however, that there often are distinct individual reasons for troubles in the lives of Christians. In fact, in the lives of all people, God is so great that he is concerned with and involved in the lives of billions of people, 3 billion people at least today, all over the world at the same time. The God who created this world that's so great that scientists can't even measure it. That God is so great that he is able to be personally, individually involved in the lives of billions of people at the same time all over the world, and to have reasons for events that come into their lives. So we must be alert to the fact that there often are personal, individual reasons for troubles which come into the lives of persons. Adversity does not necessarily mean an evidence of divine disfavor. It may simply be God at work in your life. It often can be said of us that you asked for patience and God gave you tribulation. Or it can be said that you prayed for faith and you got trials. But this is God at work. So this evening, I want to list for you 7 additional reasons that I know about in the Scriptures for troubles in the lives of Christians. I shall list these 7 additional reasons, and next Sunday night we will take them up one by one in the Bible and study them and see how they fit into God's purposes and works. But let me give them to you this evening so that you may, if you wish, begin to think about them. And I suppose that undoubtedly there are other reasons than these. These just happen to be 7 reasons I have found in the Scriptures. And I'm quite sure that as I study the Bible longer and know the Bible better, I shall discover in the Bible additional reasons why God permits troubles in the lives of Christians. But I will suggest to you tonight these 7 that we shall be studying together in the weeks to come. The first of these is, or rather the second, because I've already given you the first reason for some troubles in the lives of Christians. The second reason is to make us aware of weaknesses and of strengths in our characters. I'm tempted at this point to elaborate, but I should wait until I can teach that. Let me simply state it again. Another purpose for troubles in the lives of Christians is to make them aware of areas of weakness in their character or areas of strength in their character. Thirdly, to develop gifts and characteristics which are going to be needed and used later. To develop gifts and characteristics which are going to be needed and used later. And fourthly, to correct, or that is, to discipline and to turn the person from disobedience, sin, and error. Fifthly, the consequences of breaking the will of God. Some troubles are just the effects of violating the will of God. And last, to bring glory to God before men. Unless I have unintentionally omitted one of the 7 additional, I've given to you 7 other reasons why troubles come into the lives of Christians. But events are only as effective as are our responses to them. As we begin to draw to a conclusion of our study this evening, let me invite you to turn for a moment to the book of James and notice the truth that is presented to us in the Scriptures, James chapter 1, where we find that the events that God permits into our lives are only as effective as are our responses to them. We notice in the 3rd verse and verses following that James is speaking about troubles in the lives of Christians. Knowing this, that the trial of your faith works patience, but let it have its perfect work. That is, the trials are intended here for a purpose, but you must respond in such a way that those events will have their intended end. And then he goes on to speak about how to respond. And in verse 12, we read that when blessed is the man who endures the testing. The word temptation that's used here is not referring to temptation to overt sin. As you know, the word temptation, as used in the first 12 verses of the first chapter of James, is the word that means a testing, a trial, a trouble. Then at verse 13 and following, we begin to have the temptation that means an inducement to commit evil or sin. But in the first few verses, James is speaking about trouble and difficulty and tests and trial. But he points out the fact that these events, in order to have their intended purpose, demand on our part a right response. Blessed is the man. But he says, let it have its perfect work. And in verse 12, blessed is the person who endures the trial. he shall receive the crown of life. I like to think of John in this regard, John the Apostle, of whom we read over in the Revelation that he wrote these words in chapter 1 and verse 9. I was on an isle called Patmos. And anyone who knows the Bible knows that that means trouble. All at once. I was on an isle called Patmos. But the next words are so tremendously inspiring. But I was in the Spirit. You see, it's very, very, very possible and intended and probable that the Christian who is experiencing an event because God has a specific individual purpose by allowing it, in the midst of trouble, his response is the key. John the Apostle could be on Patmos. That's like Alcatraz, you know. But he could be on Patmos and say, but I was in the Spirit. This is the thing that's important. Our response to it. I'm reminded, and it's amazing what even the natural man can do who will respond to trial properly. Even the unsaved man who knows how to respond to trouble discovers it has a beneficial end. There was a certain man who was born with a bad back. When he lay on his back, he suffered acute pain. He also had a nasal obstruction that gave him tremendous trouble when he lay on his back. His name was Pain. He also had a nasal obstruction that gave him tremendous trouble when he lay on his back. His name was Michelangelo. You gaze in wonder and admiration at the paintings by Michelangelo on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. To execute them, he had to lie flat on his back on scaffoldings all day, every day, for 20 months, enduring excruciating pain in his back and with his nose so closed up he could hardly breathe. But he responded in a way that produced some of the great masterpieces. Even natural man can respond to trouble so that it has beneficial results. Beethoven wrote his great Ninth Symphony, you know, after he had become stone deaf. He responded to this time of trouble in a way that's amazing. He said one time, I have compensated mentally for my defects of hearing. I will take fate by the throat. I will hear in heaven. And he wrote that great Ninth Symphony with all of its beauty. A man stone deaf, so that when he personally conducted the symphony one time and when he had finished it, he stood there unaware that the crowd had been so moved that there was thunderous applause and he didn't know anything about it till a man came and turned him around. Completely stone deaf, but he responded in a way that had tremendous effects. Now, this is particularly true in Christian experience. Your response to the trial determines the effect. There are events that come into your life that have individual purposes. Some events of trouble and trial that come into your life, I'm convinced, as I've said, are just due to the fact you're a part of a world that's disordered and part of a body that has death at work in it. And I'm convinced, secondly, that you will never in this life know the reasons for many of the things that happen. But the Scriptures are very clear that there are events that come into your life that have individual reason, and that God intends you to know the reason, and that your response to it is determinative to having certain effects in your lives. And I've given you 7 of those tonight. We're going to study them together beginning next Sunday. Let us bow our heads for a brief moment of prayer.